Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. My name is John, and I am joined, as always, by JP. Hey, JP, how you doing?
How's it going?
It's going really good, man. I heard you did a lightning talk recently at your place. I kind of wanted to ask how that went, what sparked that, and how that went, and also just like how you're doing.
Yeah, I'm doing great. So every month we have an Eng meeting, and basically what this is just a chance to have a sort of informal hangout session, and it's kicked off usually by a series of talks that people sign up for / get nominated for. And as a representation of the Burbank office, my boss nominated me, and I said, sure, why not? So I was the one talk that was not in the San Francisco office.
Oh, that's cool.
There were about 8. So it's basically just like a series of talks and then a Q&A with our CTO or a panel of engineering managers and things like that. It's only the engineers, so it's no one else in product, no one else in design, no one else in the company.
Sure.
So it's kind
How
of
many
cool
people
thing.
Were in the room though that you had to do this lightning talk in front of?
So in the Burbank office there was like 10 of us, a couple people are working from home. There's only 14 engineers I think in the Burbank office. In San Francisco, I think I have no idea of how many people were actually there because the way that the camera situation was set up, I was only looking at like the podium. And so for all I know, there could have been like 200 people watching me, but...
Oh, interesting. So yeah. It was like shared via webcam between the two offices.
Exactly. Yeah. And
interesting.
And I didn't even have control over the deck because it, technical reasons. So I was literally saying next slide every time I had to transition slides.
Wow, that's rough.
Yeah. But my talk was on how diverse teams make better products. And one of the examples we talked about, even in this podcast, was about the whole crash test dummy thing. About, in 2011, up until like 2011, we were only modeling our crash test dummies based off of the average male and women and children, things like that. So overall, the talk went well. I got so nervous. Public speaking, I thought like, I do a podcast. People were like, oh, you're going to be fine. You're not going to be nervous. You seem so, you're like, outgoing or whatever. And I'm like, I'm not outgoing. I'm introverted. I hate public speaking. This is going to be very painful for me. Overall, I did well, but definitely was a little nervous. I think it's just one of those. I think public speaking and like podcasting are way too different things. But yeah, overall, it went well.
Cool. I'm glad to hear that. And I just like want to commend and acknowledge the level of stress that there must have been in the public speaking. Because not only is it public speaking, like it's one thing to like give a toast at a wedding in front of a bunch of people that you may know, friends or strangers, but it's a whole nother level to go up, amongst your coworkers and peers and bosses, put yourself on a stage and say, I'm going to speak on this topic. And one that not everyone might not be so open to, the idea of diversity in tech, like it's a little bit controversial. And I think that took a lot of courage. And I think that was probably really good for you to do. I'm sure the talk was awesome as well. But man, so do you have any like recommendations or thoughts for anyone thinking about speaking in front of like a lightning talk at a conference or at a meetup? Like, would you do it again? Or is this just something you would avoid? Like, do you have any thoughts in that area at all?
Yes, two things. And I'm sure there's more tips out there. But first tip is speak on something that you could speak passionately about. Mm. And luckily, this was a talk that I could talk about for longer than 5 minutes. I only had 5 minutes, but if I was given 30 minutes, I certainly could have filled that time very easily. So one, talk about something that you can talk about passionately. And two, rehearse the shit out of it. I don't know why I decided to put this off. I decided to put off rehearsing until like 2 days before. And so by the time I actually did it, I was like, man, I could have rehearsed this a lot more. I think rehearsing a lot sort of irons out all of the nervousness that you have and also lets you speak without really having to rely heavily on your speaker notes. So those are my two little things is talk on a subject that you can talk about passionately and rehearse a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I think preparation is like the number one way to battle anxiety, especially when speaking about public speaking or that type of performance-based thing. If you're doing a pitch for an investor, that type of thing. If you're feeling stressed or nervous, like prepare. Rehearse. That'll really definitely buffer that. That's super cool. So let's jump into the meat of our topic this week, which is actually all about planning. I'm really excited to get into this. So we're still walking through Extreme Programming by Kent Beck. We've just gotten so many amazing insights from this book. but the book's coming to a close. But this specific chapter 12 deals all with planning and managing scope and dealing with planning in general. So we're going to go through a little bit from the book, talk about our own personal experiences in planning, and then kind of wrap up with a few more things from the book that are some awesome insights. So you want to kick off our section on planning, JP?
Yeah, so this is something that I think all of us can relate to. And it's interesting because you and I are coming from different perspectives. So I'm in a more formalized team that, you know, practices agile. We have very rigid 2-week sprints. At some point in those sprints, we have a sprint planning meeting. At the end of the sprint, we have a sprint retro. We even have a sprint estimation session. I don't know what your process is like, which is going to be interesting to talk through the differences. But here's a quote. And I promise the only quote that we will read off in this chapter about planning. And I think it's worthwhile. So the quote is, planning is an exercise in listening, speaking, and aligning goals for a specific time period. It is valuable input for each team member. Without planning, we are individuals with haphazard connections and effectiveness. We are a team when we plan and work in harmony, end quote. And so I think that's a good way to kick off this idea of how you plan for the coming weeks and how you plan a feature. So I think it'll be interesting going through how we get features from conception to reality.
Yeah. I remember there's a quote from one of our past episodes that we keep referencing, but it's just this idea that complicated things are complicated. Like, there's only so much you can simplify things. And I think planning is one of those things that you can't over... Like, you can try to over-optimize it, and it's just not going to work in the way you hope it is. You can try to simplify it, and there's only so much that it can be simplified because it involves people and the way we communicate and perceive things. And inherently, like, it involves relationships, and that's something that you can't over-optimize. Like, you can't optimize, quote-unquote, a friendship beyond a point to where it just, like, doesn't work. The optimization breaks the thing itself. And I think that planning is another thing that we need to acknowledge, that it is complicated, that it requires its own discipline and set of processes, but also realize that this isn't something that you can just fully automate and set and forget. This is a practice that you need to lean into. So XP talks about planning at any time scale with basically 4 steps. So this is the main 4 steps. So you got to list out the shit that you got to get done. You've got to estimate the shit that's got to get done. You've got to set a budget for the planning cycle. And then you've got to agree on the work that needs to be done within that budget. As you negotiate, like, don't change the estimate to the budget, change the scope. And really, he used this metaphor, which I think was good, about grocery shopping. Like, you go to the grocery store, you get the items you need, you've got $100 for your groceries for the week. And, like, you put all the stuff on the conveyor belt and it rings up to $105. And ultimately, you have to put something back. You have to put something back on the shelf. You don't have that extra $5. And so picking which items you put back is the idea of adjusting based on scope. So it's not like you're going to talk to the grocery and be like, okay, I know I want to buy 6 apples, but do you have shitty apples instead of these apples? Like, give me just garbage apples. I want ones that are rotten or of lower quality. It's like, no, you're not going to compromise the quality of the food you're going to buy. You're not going to try to negotiate on the price of each individual item with the checker. You're going to negotiate the scope, how much items that you're buying from them. And I think that is one of the really amazing takeaways from these extreme programming principles that I think is one of the biggest ones, that is the biggest benefit to us, is not negotiating based on time or money, but based on just how many things you're trying to build, which is huge.
Cool. Yeah. So I thought it'd be interesting if we talked about how we plan features and how we plan for what's in scope and what's not in scope. So I wanted to pose this question for just open discussion.
Cool.
Because it was a very short chapter, and I think we basically covered all
of, pretty much the chapter.
All of the good stuff. So I wanted to pose an open question for both of us to sort of go through, which is, walk us through how you plan a new feature. So in other words, how do you bring a new idea from concept all the way to reality? So from concept to production.
Yeah. So as people may not know, I run a small remote development firm. So it's me plus about 4 other developers and 2 designers and a project manager. And so we design and build mobile apps and maintain web apps and features and things like that. So we are all remote. So we've had to come up with a process around planning that supports a remote work environment. And this has been a lot of iterations on this process. And we lived without a process in that state of chaos for a really long time. And I think part of that was I always felt like I had the excuse to be able to do so because we're across four time zones and we're all remote. So we can't get a board up on the wall and do Scrum properly. We can't do Agile properly. And it was all just excuses. And so ultimately we, and then only in the past maybe 3 or 4 months, we've really refined this process. I brought on a project manager who's helped us really refine this process and keep this process running. And so kind of going back to this idea of planning is complicated and it takes dedication, like we had to straight up hire someone to do this as the main component of her job. The main thing she does is manage this process and keep us all accountable to this process and to continue to refine it. So out of a 7-person team, one of those people is basically just dedicated to keep our planning and processes within planning executing appropriately. So that said, in those caveats, and like this is an ongoing refinement, but this is kind of our current process that we've got so far.
Can I stop you for a second?
Of course, yeah.
Before we get into it, would you mind breaking down the composition of that 7-person team? So is that like 6 engineers and your product designer, or like what is like the makeup of that?
Yeah, so currently we have 4 full stack developers. Some have different specialties amongst others, but we have 4 developers, 2 designers, a project manager, and me, which I wear kind of all the hats.
Okay.
So that's the current makeup. So basically you pair 1 designer with 2 developers, and that kind of keeps everyone busy enough and the work defined enough. That's kind of the overall structure. Everybody rotates on all projects and everybody rotates with all different people. So you pair program with everybody, you work with every designer, everybody's always working with everybody. But that's the basic makeup of the team. And then just so we have context, where are you currently? Because you're going to be interjecting about how you plan day to day. What is your team structure look like and kind of what are those rough roles?
Sure. So I don't know if I mentioned this on this podcast, but I actually recently switched teams. So now the composition of our team is an engineering manager, 2 engineers, including myself, 1 designer, and 2 marketing people. The two marketing people is an interesting addition. So yeah, we're a team called Buyer Growth. We don't necessarily fit into a specific step in the buyer's journey in the funnel, which is usually how we broke down our teams previously. So the other teams are made up of about 4 to 5 engineers, 1 designer, and 1 product manager. So our situation is a little bit different. And so I have a process that I've been used to up until switching teams and a process that we are trying to figure out. So I think this is going to be a super interesting conversation.
Cool. Yeah, awesome. So with that, let's jump into kind of the process that we currently use and this whole idea is how do we bring something from an idea into a shipped feature? So how do we refine that and do that? So here's kind of the main phases that we've got, which is a pitch, the design, the client review, the estimate, and the plan, and then finally the client approval. So you can substitute client for stakeholder, like whatever that person is in your world. It's not always necessary client. For us, it's like an end client because we are a development agency. So that's what we do. So let's kind of break this down. The first thing is the pitch. So this usually comes from the client, and it's that like text message or email you get that basically says, I want to build XYZ. This is going to be the thing. I want to build this thing. So we need messaging, or we need likes in our conversation tool. Like those are the different things that are what we call a pitch or an idea. So let me give a specific example. So WizTutor, we've mentioned this application in the past. Me and JP have both worked on it. It's an app where you can find and book nearby tutors for in-person tutoring. My firm still does the active maintenance and kind of feature updates for that app. Even years later, it's still running, which is awesome. So the pitch that came from the founder, and I'm actually putting the entire pitch from our founder in the show notes. So you can actually see like how ambiguous and unclear these types of pitches come in.
Let me give you
the TLDR of the pitch. So when students search for but don't book a tutor, let relevant tutors message those students. So this would happen through this new tab called Student Seeking. So this tab would show up for tutors. So basically, if you're a student searching, when you search, you kind of leave crumbs of that search and we know you haven't booked someone. So we surface that so you can kind of reach out as a tutor and bug them and try to book it. Any questions on that kind of pitch, or is that clear enough?
Seems clear to me. So in my head, it's like you have students and you have tutors. Some students can be seen as like leads. So we're basically giving leads to our tutors so that they can follow up and pick up money off of the ground, so to speak.
Yeah. So in your organization, JP, where do pitches come from? And like who's like pitching new product ideas? Where does that come from in your org?
So this is interesting because Okay, so I have a question to follow up your question.
Yeah, sure.
First, is typically when you get a pitch, where is that pitch coming from? Is that just like poof, an idea came in your client's head and they just like, I want likes or I want this feature? Or is it based off of, you know, some research that shows that the current implementation
I mean, there has been times when it's based on research or customer interviews or reviews we've gotten in the app store that say like, oh, if only this app had this XYZ feature. Mm-hmm. But it's mostly based on the kind of founder's intuition is where pitches come from. Actually, pitches as well do come from our team. So we encourage designers and developers that if you have an idea or feature for a project we're working on, like let's pitch it to our clients because that puts us in a great position.
Right.
Ultimately, we're all trying to build a better product, but most times the pitches and ideas come from the client who just have some kind of epiphany, which depending on the client comes from a varying level of research and fact-based and more gut-based, which is important too. Like that's part of the entrepreneur and startup journey.
Yeah. So for us, it's interesting because we do a lot of planning, and I don't know if this will like sort of derail your sort of like steps, but we sort of zoom out at a higher level. And so we plan for each quarter beforehand.
Wow.
And even before that, I think we try to set OKRs at the beginning of the year, I believe. And obviously things are malleable and you can change them as you go along if you decide that all of a sudden your OKR is no longer relevant. So OKR, for those of you that don't know, stands for objective key result. If I tried to explain what that really is, I'd probably...
That's a whole podcast episode.
Yeah, I would probably butcher that. So basically, we have these like guiding principles. And okay, so ultimately, to answer your question, what sort of guides our pitches is we have metrics that we're trying to move. So we have like a huge dashboard of various charts.
Yeah.
And some charts are more important than the others. And, you know, when one chart is like, hey, I think we can move this metric and really move the needle and make... which makes the company X amount more dollars, this we should plan around that. And so we have like brainstorming sessions where everyone kind of just throws spaghetti at the wall.
Sure.
Designers, developers, marketing.
So everyone
people.
Pitches in that case.
Yeah. So everyone just sort of like, you know, it's like the typical like Google sprint thing where you put sticky notes on the wall. Mm-hmm. And then it's sort of up to our product manager to ultimately be the product like owner. And so they are sort of responsible for saying like, okay, we think that these sticky notes are going to give us the most impact. Let's figure out a way that we can flesh these features out. And then sort of, and that's sort of the initial stage of the planning, basically.
Cool. That makes a ton of sense. I love that your pitches come from the context of your OKRs or your metrics that you're trying to move as a business. And that's probably the difference between a more mature business like yourselves and just kind of a startup trying to figure things out. So once we have a pitch, the next step in our organization is we take this pitch, we first tease out what the founder's trying to say, because sometimes it's not so coherent, or it's maybe, but we tease out what the intent of the, what the idea or the pitch is, get the nugget of the idea, and we hand that off to design. So actually our designers very much play this dual role of kind of product manager and designer. So they think very high level about the user experience and the feature sets. And so we hand off this pitch to this designer to kind of define it and recommend a scope. And so that comes really in three main stages. The first is questioning the work, two is defining the work, and three is handing off the defined work. So in the idea of questioning the work, it's, you know, does this even need to exist? Question if the feature exists at all. Can this be solved with off-the-shelf stuff? So a lot of times we'll push back to a client and say, I know you want this feature. Try it with Zapier. Try it with a Google spreadsheet, especially in the context of startups. That helps us refine the feature and make sure that it has value in the world before we go building it. And features often die in this very first stage of a designer questioning the work. The next step after we kind of question that work, see if we even need to build it, feel like we need to. The next thing is to define the work, which is the first step, I feel like this, which is often productive, is to name all the things. So attach nouns and verbs to the functionality. So in this context of WizTutor and this idea of student seeking, we came up with our designer came up with the idea of leads. So student seeking became leads, and you instantly jumped to that word, which, you know, is very fitting. And then the idea of message this student became reply to lead. So this noun came out of a lead reply, quote unquote. So we have this thing, a lead and a lead reply, because there was some functionality. There was a for instance, where we didn't want to have more than three tutors reach out to a student because we didn't want them to be overwhelmed. So we needed a way to track which leads had been replied to. And originally we were thinking about doing this through messaging, but the designer had the insight of like, oh no, there's this thing, a lead reply. Once there's three lead replies against a lead, boom, it's that easy. We can just query against it. So we also need to figure out where this lives in the context of the existing feature set. So like, where in the app does this fit? And then once we have the entities and we kind of know where those entities fit, it's figuring out the life cycles of these entities. So how do they get created, viewed, destroyed? So example, in this context, a student search activity generates a lead. A tutor can view relevant leads. A tutor can create lead replies against the leads. And then kind of from there. So we have that kind of life cycle against these. And we ask a lot of questions, try to get ahead of pitfalls. And oftentimes a designer will ping a developer, maybe pair with a dev, tell them what they're thinking, talk through it to avoid any technical pitfalls. And then kind of last step of this design phase is the actual output of the designer is just a low fidelity mockup. It's usually handed off with a screen recording. So it'll be 3 or 4 relevant screenshots, small pieces of it, very low fidelity, often sketches or just very low fidelity Figma kind of wireframes. And they screen record and just talk about the way it works. So they give the context. As a student, I'm doing a search. As a tutor, I view the leads. I reply to the lead. And we try to talk these. And then overall, this process, we try to time box it, this iteration, to just a couple hours. So like anywhere from 1 to 4 hours at most for something larger. But that's the basic design process that gets handed off back to the client. So they come with a pitch and we get them that refinement back to the client, usually in about within a week. We try to turn it as fast as we can so the momentum doesn't die.
Okay, so interesting. So step one is the pitch. Step two is design. Although I think labeling this as design kind of threw me off because I was like, oh man, you just like go in and you just start designing the feature already. No, but it's more than that. They're actually ironing out the bugs. They're sort of, they're trying to break it in a way. Like think of the different edge cases and see like, hey, do we really need this? They're coming up with the nouns. They're doing research. So when you say designers, I don't know, my head instantly jumps to like visual design, but this is actual like product design and a little bit of research. So your designers sound to me like their superpowers are product design, visual design, and also research. They're like kind of like a combination of those three things. Okay, so that's interesting. So you actually give the low fidelity mockup back to the client after that.
Yeah, so they never see it in a polished state before we start dev. And a big reason is because our existing platforms, most of what we're building, the first step is a design system. So picking a front-end framework, like we all know the design system. We all know what colors everything should look like, what font it is, and what padding. So we're not worried about aesthetics at all. We're only worried about functionality and defining the scope of the functionality at this stage. There might be aesthetic tweaks as we get further down the road, but generally aesthetics aren't high on the list of my clients. Like we need the functionality, we need it too much. Market as quick as possible. And so, yeah, that low fidelity design gets handed back to the client and then the client reviews it. So we shoot an email with the mockups and the screen recording attached. This is kind of step three, is that client review and approval. If there's tweaks, we make a new low fidelity, like if there's tweaks needed, we just kind of go back through this process, back to a refined pitch, back to this kind of design and definition phase. And then with this, we get the must-haves and nice-to-haves locked down from the client review. So we kind of start to negotiate what's in scope and out of scope. So trying to figure out what those things are. For example, this leads functionality, originally we were going to charge tutors per lead reply. So if tutors wanted to reply to a lead, it would cost them $1, kind of the way Thumbtacks and other platforms does it. But very quickly, we realized this was out of scope. It wasn't a must have, it was a nice to have, and it was a whole feature set that could be negotiated at a later time. So it was like, what is the actual core that we want to get live to our users? It's the idea of responding to leads. And at some point, if we want to charge for it, then that's a whole design iteration on that. So yeah, it's really like we have, at that point, we all have very clear alignment on what we're trying to build, the must-haves in it, and have a rough wireframe and a design system to implement that wireframe. So really that's the next step, which is what we call estimating and planning. So once we have this alignment on everything, we have a developer sit down and review these wireframes, the client must-haves, and this is where we really come up with the plan. We break this kind of feature into the user stories related to the feature. So that's where we break it into work that's, you know, each user story is no more than 3 to 5 hours, somewhere in there. We plan the technical approach. We make any recommendations. And so that's where that happens. And in that estimation, I just had a couple tips about like keys to estimating more accurately. So we look at the history. So is there something similar we've done? Do we have the hours from that? Break things down as small as you can. The smaller you get something, the more accurate you can be about estimating against it. And thinking about the multiple contexts and states. I feel like oftentimes when we miss scope on something, we think, oh wait, what about the admin view for this? You know, what happens when only one tutor replies to a lead, but 3 weeks goes by? Like, does it still sit in the leads, or is there a stale fail state of this lead? Like, what are all those different contexts and states and the things the designer might not have thought of? So that's at the point that we really estimate and plan. There may be some little back and forth with the designer just to refine the ideas and concepts. But from there, the delivery of this estimation phase is basically the epic or feature, if you will, broken out into user stories that have hours against them. So we should have a collection of 8 or 9 cards that each are, you know, 1 to 5 hours. And then if we add up all those cards, user stories, we have a number on what is an estimate for this work. So that's when we're able to bring that back to the client and say, you've seen the screenshots. We're talking about estimating the same thing. Here's, you know, the breakdown of how this breaks down. Here's all the things on the grocery store conveyor belt and what they all cost. You know, what do you want to put back on the shelf and what do you keep here? So this is the most important part about negotiating against scope and knowing what's getting in and when it can get done. Because now we all know what we're talking about. We are on the same page of what this stuff is and kind of a plan of approach.
Okay, so in the previous step, you had the initial client review. The client said, A, B, and C are my must-haves, D, E, and F are my nice-to-haves. Then you take that, you formalize a plan, and then you basically say, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F is going to take this amount of hours.
Yep.
And then they come back to you and say, oh, you know what? Actually, our must, because then you're like, okay, this is going to, let's just say like, oh, this is going to take 2 weeks to do. They're like, ooh, we want this in, can we do it in like 1 week? And maybe we only do an A and B as our must haves.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's where in this specific example of the student leads concept that we've, this is something we literally deployed, I think Monday, like I think 2 days ago, we deployed this feature to the users. But that's where this idea of charging, like we had a bunch of user stories related to charging for these leads, and that doubled the scope here. And he's like, well, I don't want to wait 4 weeks to get this live. I want to get this live as soon as possible. So we just cut the scope in half by removing this entire. So we had planned and estimated out this idea of charging for these leads. And that's when we really negotiated on that scope. So if you break down all these things into estimates, you kind of have each of these user stories and you can stack rank them. And then if something takes longer than something else, you can simply cut that out of it. And it's like, you can come back to your client and say, hey, you know, user story A, which was your number one, took twice as long. So that means you're not getting user story D within the scope. So that's how you can negotiate scope in real terms. It's easy to say like, oh, don't compromise quality, but like, how does that break down? That's actually how it's broken down. And this is working really well. Clients seem to be really happy with this approach. And we're able to get things to market faster because what's great about it is we can kind of identify, well, if we finish just these 3 out of the 12 user stories, we actually have functionalities to users. That's about getting those working slices to users faster. So once we have that estimation and we negotiated that scope and everybody's on the same page, the must-haves and nice-to-haves, it's approved. And we move forward with the ticket through a whole development process, which I think is for a future episode. But that's really how we take an idea and get it ready for development. Because at this point, now we have user stories, we have money from the client, we're ready to go code.
Interesting. So I'd like to maybe compare and contrast that with sort of the process we do at Opendoora.
And I'd love to hear that.
And I could be very succinct and brief about this because I don't want to talk about this too long. I have other questions that I want to discuss.
Cool.
So I mentioned that we have like a big quarterly planning. So everything, the features that we work on have been planned out way in advance. So it would never be like, oh, we should do this feature and then like turn around and then 2 weeks later, we're implementing it because everything has to be backed by what metrics we're moving and what impact we're having on users. So we like to plan things out way in advance. So let's fast forward. Let's assume that we've done some quarterly planning. So we do quarterly planning and we actually have a shared doc that gets sent out to our team, designers, engineers, PMs, marketing people. And you know, you're free to add ideas to this shared paper doc. So let's assume that we have a plan for Q4 ready. And let's assume that my PM has distilled out the most important thing. So now we're approaching a sprint, right? So we plan for the upcoming sprint. So let's say that we're doing a sprint planning meeting. At that point, we'll have just like a huge backlog of things. And it's the product manager's role to decide, okay, we have this backlog of like 40 things. Which 10 things should we bring into the next sprint?
Yeah.
And so that is more or less a collaborative process. So we bring things into the sprint and then we all sit down and estimate it, like how long this would take. And then and then from there, it's sort of a grab bag of like, okay, I want to take this and this, and then the other engineer can take this and that. So these tickets are, it's easy to forget like why you're doing these things. So we like to pose questions at the like beginning and the end of, and this is something we recently started doing. We like to pose the question of like, so how are we solving X, Y, and Z problems? And the last time that question was posed, my product manager had to answer like, we are like literally just saying it out loud, because when you see like a list of tickets in Jira, it's easy to like lose sight of, you know, zooming out from a higher level and seeing like, okay, the reason we're doing these tickets is because it's the goal is to move the like certain metrics. So literally my PM was like, we are solving X problem by doing like this ticket, and this ticket, obviously getting more specific.
That's cool.
Yeah, by doing this ticket, and this ticket, and this ticket, with the hopes that we will move X, Y, and Z metrics. So like, I think just reiterating on that sort of reminds everyone as a team that we're like doing things for specific reasons. And I think it's more important for us to do something like that because we do so much planning ahead of time. Like the features I'm working on now were probably planned months ago. And so because they were planned so long ago, it's easy to forget the why.
Yeah, the why behind it. And I think that's so important to tie the, you know, the specific JavaScript errors you're trying to get through today back with a why for a user empathy at some point. Yep. Otherwise, it's like just work for work's sake and it gets super frustrating. The thing that I like about your guys' approach is there's these formal sprints that kind of time box a feature's delivery within a quarter. And that probably helps adjust your scope as well. It's like, Well, we only have so much time. The thing that I don't love about our approach is we don't really group features within two formal sprints, if you will. And so sometimes delivery can get pushed because it's a little bit more loose and kind of done per feature. Like each feature is its own kind of sprint instead of user stories within it that gets negotiated in itself. But I think we're trying to figure out the balance between having a set date and kind of a deadline and kind of sprint periods. And so it's a little bit harder to do that kind of formal sprint when you're not showing up at an office scheduled all at the same time. And I think when also in the startup world, like things shift so fast, like there's a lot of value in having a pitch go through this process from start to finish within 2 or 3 weeks and just kind of ongoing, and each pitch lives in its own asynchronous life cycle. And that's kind of where we're living now, but there's definitely pros and cons within it, so we're working through that. Super interesting.
Yeah, so I think the final thing is that, and I'm sure you also cut scope. It's not just like in the estimation and planning, you lay out the estimation for how long a feature will take, and then the client says, okay, let's cut scope in these areas. I'm sure you also cut scope during development.
Oh, of course.
It's not right. So yeah, that's much like ours too, but I don't necessarily, and I could be wrong, and maybe I'm speaking incorrectly, but we don't necessarily cut scope in the planning phases. We try to plan for, let's try to ship these features.
Interesting.
I think the scope, cutting scope is more on the fly. So for example, the feature that I'm working on this sprint was like, oh, hey, I can ship, I mean, I'm blocked because of these reasons and I didn't, And no one could have foreseen that this would be a blocker. And then so my PM's like, can we ship without it? And I'm like, sure, certainly. But I mean, it's obviously there's more conversation around like,
of course,
are we doing, you know, if, because there's definitely a balance of like, are you cutting scope and it's like detrimental to the user, or like, can we cut scope and it doesn't really matter?
Is it a nice to have or is it a must have? I mean, that's kind of what it comes back to. I think I would love to do that more scope cutting on the fly, but I think the issue is for us is we have a client who's paying us a sum of money for a set of features, and there's an expectation there that it's going to look a certain way. So I think for us, cutting the scope more on the front side when design iteration is cheaper in the design phase before there's code makes a lot of sense and sets better expectations. And it's always like a really great surprise when a nice to have makes it for the client. Like we're able to get it in for them. They're like, oh, cool. You got likes in the comments. Like, awesome. That's so great that we got that in. And so it's trying to like under promise and over deliver as much as we can. So that's part of the approach there and the thinking there. Cool. So what are some other questions? Let's keep going through this planning stuff.
Okay, cool. So I want to jump to this question, which is, talk about a time when planning failed and scope creep was real. How do you think this could have been prevented?
Ooh, okay. This is a great question and very recent and painful for me. like as recent as a couple weeks ago. So
same.
I mean, this story starts about a year ago or so. I got a client reach out and they wanted to build a huge web app. Had great chemistry with the founder, so excited about the project. So basically I sat down and the same speech that I give to every founder I work with is like, I see your vision. I see where you want to go in 3 years. I see this thing. I'm on board. I want to help you build it. We negotiated kind of rough rates and actually an equity agreement on the thing because that's kind of how we work. We really come on as partners in projects. So the first recommendation I made though is that we take, you know, 2 or 3 weeks and we better define the scope of the project. We really lay out what features get in, who it's for, what audiences we're trying to address, like that initial product research, which is like so minimum. I was like, you know, 2 to 4 weeks somewhere in there, we'll charge a very low retainer just to define this. Like, let's wrangle this thing in and define it. Once we define the work, we can put a price tag and a date on that work, on that batch of work. So like, here it is, here's V1, it's $25,000, it's $35,000, it's going to deliver on XY date, whatever that looks like. The client pushed really hard and pushed back on this idea of, you know, I don't want to take the time to define the work up front. I want to work agile. I just want to get started. Let's start code on Monday. Yeah, very in quotes, agile, very loosely there. And I allowed myself to go along with this because I liked the idea of an ongoing client relationship where we're just working together, building this thing very collaboratively, and just kind of going through it and figuring it out as we go, like startup style. Like, this is lean startup methodology, right? And so because I have worked in the past where it's almost more of a waterfall, like we define way too much upfront, and that has a lot of pitfalls in itself as well. So I said, well, let's really lean into this agile approach and do this kind of thing, which basically was shorthand for like, let's not plan anything and let's just start coding this thing. The long story short is the scope creep was absolutely massive. So not only the feature list got so long, but like features within features. So an example was like photo messaging. So the idea of messaging, we built it to support file attachments and photos before there was a single user actually using the messaging tool. Like, absolutely insane scope creep in that way. And we spent way too much time on functionality. It was just totally thrown out the window. We did this whole review system, like a ton of different functionality that was ultimately just thrown out the window. And this was all done in development before really any real users besides a very small, there was like 12 or 20 beta testers that were kind of clicking around and playing with it. But in the end, the client spent probably 4 times what my initial estimate was. It took twice as long and they still don't have a full working product. And we're trying to negotiate like what to do now. We're both looking down and just going like, oh shit, like this is where we're at. And more than anyone, I blame myself, not because we didn't do great work and we didn't work hard and write a lot of great code, but because I didn't push back and really push for a set scope and time box on this thing and like dig what that looked like and define that. And really, it's just for a lack of a plan is how this thing ended up the way it was. And I'm still trying to work with the founder to see what we can do to get this into a more of a working and shippable state. And hopefully we can reach that point in our kind of negotiations, figuring things out right now. But as of right now, the project's on hold and it's not a great place to be.
So it sounds to me it wasn't necessarily where planning failed. It was like a lack of planning. So I guess, yeah. It doesn't sound like you did your like 5 magic steps, which I actually seem like they would have helped a lot.
So much. And even at a high level, doing the 5 magic steps, because I feel like the first thing when you're starting from scratch is walk through those 5 magic steps for just at a very high level, like, what is this thing? Get the 10,000 foot of this thing. And I think we had the 10,000 foot of the app. Obviously, we didn't come in with no information. We had a 2 or 3 page spec doc, and there was some information here. But feature by feature, we didn't plan the feature in this way, and we weren't disciplined about our approach through feature by feature because we were trying to move so fast. And did we get a hell of a lot of functionality written really fast? Yeah, like, it was crazy. We got a huge feature list super fast. But in the end, like, the features aren't very cohesive. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more functionality in areas where it's not needed and less where it's really needed. So there's just this lack of discipline around planning that really bit us in the ass on this project for sure.
Can I try something potentially weird and on the spot?
I'm ready.
Okay, so if we were to do a postmortem on this on the spot right now, and yeah, I asked you to do like a 5 whys type of a thing, what do you think the final why would be at the end of that line of like why this project was not able to get off the ground?
Yeah, my instinct is to respond with my pride. like that's the instinct I want to give. Sure. Like, oh yeah, I can figure this thing out by the seat of my pants, and I can wrangle a whole team and herd the cats and get this thing out the door. And I think that there's a fundamental. I think part of the problem here was a fundamental overconfidence mm-hmm. in my pride and allowing that kind of negotiation to go south and not being willing to like be humble and say like, no, I really don't know what this product is and I can't define it by the seat of my pants. I've got to better define this. I don't know if that's what I'd really end up doing for the formal postmortem. And I haven't done a postmortem yet only because I'm still hoping to move this forward. Like I'm not at all calling this project a relationship dead by any means, but mm-hmm. at the moment, we don't have a working product and the project's on hold. So maybe it is time I sit down and do a postmortem to really get to the nuts and bolts of that. And I think my pride and then as well as just under communication, like not having the courage to really push back. And I think that's what's an interesting tenet about extreme programming is this idea of courage and saying like, I know you want it faster. I know you have the money to move this thing faster, but having the courage to say, trying to move this fast without a plan is only going to delay. It's like there's this quote in XP that I wrote down here, which is compromising scope, not quality, time, or cost. Here's the quote here. Quote, lowering the quality of your work doesn't eliminate the work. It shifts it later, creates the illusion of progress. You pay in reduced satisfaction and damage relationships, end quote. And that's where I'm at. It's outside of the idea of scope, but it's even outside the idea of just being honest about what we can and can't plan on the fly and the level of involvement. And I think there was some responsibility to bear on the client side as well, which was the level of involvement wasn't enough in ongoing with the client. And so we were building without feedback. And if we really did have a more agile approach where there was regular reviews built into the system, I think there is a way to do that approach with a lack of a plan and have success. I really do. But I think it requires a lot more feedback from the client, which is ultimately not the client's fault because I should have pushed for that feedback and should have put the work on hold when we weren't getting that feedback. That's a lot of rambling. I hope that makes sense.
No, yeah, it does. I think this is, which is a pretty cool example to contrast from the process that we were talking about earlier in this episode, basically the five magic steps of how you get from concept to reality. Yeah. The way that I interpret your story sort of is like you were just so like eager to work on something. And sometimes that eagerness gets the best of us because you're just like, fuck it. I want to work on 100%. This. Like, let's just work on this right now and like
the
bang
founder
out this
and
app.
I both. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So you were sort of in this world of being in the wild, wild west where, you know, practices and principles were sort of shunned, for example, like, you know, having that continuous feedback, having the courage to say, hey, no, we should take a step back and maybe plan this out a little bit more. So maybe this is also kind of an example where extreme programming practices and values could have maybe alleviated some of the pain of going down too far of the beaten path of like, you know, because at some point you're kind of like too far in and you're like, shit, like,
yep,
can we just like stop, rewind, zoom out a little bit, plan a little bit more, and maybe we can get on the right foot. But it's hard to do that. And I think that takes courage and some of the values that we talked about in earlier episodes. But yeah, I think this is definitely a situation where you could have maybe used extreme programming.
No, I should have, and I will in the future. And I'm proud that it's finally in a state of hold. Like, I feel like this relationship could have kept going in this way. And I, mm-hmm. I finally had the courage to say like, no, this isn't working. And then as well as like, I've had many conversations since in the last month or two where I caught myself wanting to overpromise, caught myself wanting to move without a plan. And I caught myself and we stopped and we went through this process and we had the discipline to plan up front to some degree. And I'm by no means propagating like waterfall development, defining mm-hmm. all the work up front. Like this is low fidelity. It should be agile and it should be flexible, but at the same time, like you need a plan, you need a budget, you need an estimate, you need to schedule the work, especially when you have people on your team. Like if you're a solo maker and you're just running a web app, like work however you want, work by the seat of your pants. That might work best for you, to be honest. Anyway, so I guess some closing thoughts on planning in general that were in the book, which was interesting. It's just the idea of planning is people. Planning takes time and intention. Like, you can't overestimate it. Use the past and facts to guide estimate, not your gut. Try to base it on things that are actually there. Don't try to over-optimize it. Like, you can't automate relationships or communication. Like, there's only a certain point you can automate this. And I think just a takeaway from me and my agency, our project manager overhead is give or take 15 to 20% of our project cost. Like, it's a very real, very needed cost in the same way that your Heroku bill is a needed cost, or a designer is a needed role. The idea of project management, you don't need a dedicated project manager necessarily, but you need someone wearing that hat and having that intention around your project. It's very, very real and very needed.
Cool. Yeah. So my closing thought on this, and the thing that resonated with me the most, is the idea that planning is communication. So everybody has thoughts. And sometimes if you don't have a formalized process, you know, you might be marginalizing somebody because, you know, maybe they are not as outspoken. So planning gives us the opportunity to get everyone's opinions on things. And it's up to people to share and have the courage to do so. But yeah, so that is my thing. I think planning is important, and I think it's important that everybody's voice gets heard.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. Let's jump into picks. What do you got for us this week, JP?
Okay, so my pick for this week is something called React Hooks. So for those of you that don't know, I'm not going to get into the spiel. Anyways, React Hooks was released, I think, like last December, at the end of last year.
It's been a few months, yeah.
And it's basically a shift in the paradigm of how you think about building React components. And for the longest time, I resisted this. Don't know why. Literally, I only started using them like 2 weeks ago, and there have been numerous tweets and blog posts about why you should use React Hooks as early as like February, or like as soon as they came out, people were like on it. And I was like, dude, fuck that. I don't have time for that. Like, I'm just gonna do what I know. And to be honest with you, it hasn't even been detrimental to my career to not have like looked at it immediately. I've like taken my time, and even so, I'm not using them all the time. I'm just kind of cherry picking simple scenarios where like, oh, I could use React Hooks here. But I'm not reaching for them like instantly. Maybe that's my fault. But bottom line is, I actually think they're pretty fucking dope. And I think it's a really clean way to write React components. That being said, I think, I don't know, this is also just my personal experience and maybe not something that I should be preaching, but I think that you don't have to jump on the newest trend or the newest technology, because I mean, it certainly didn't affect me negatively at all. So that's my little soapbox.
Yeah, I just wanted to commend you. Like, I can't believe there's a JavaScript developer who's as skilled as you who isn't overnight completely changing the way he works every single day. And that's pushing it too far, obviously. But I feel like there's so much movement sometimes in the development community. Like, throw everything out. This is the new way. Like, every single week. And I think that, like, there's a certain pragmatism to letting things shake out a bit, making sure that it's mature to a point of a certain stability before jumping in. And that's kind of the way that I like to work. But also, like, I just started getting like NPM and Webpack in projects like 3 months ago. So that's like way, way later than I should have. But yeah, I think in general, it's good to kind of wait for things to flesh out a bit. It doesn't necessarily hurt to wait. So I do have a question though. What made you finally jump into React Hooks? Like, why now, 6 months later than kind of a lot of other top JavaScript developers in your field?
Okay, so I interview quite a few people now, and there was this one candidate who really wanted to use React Hooks for a challenge. And I was like, hey, full disclosure, I've only skimmed through the docs.
Yeah,
so I mean, if you need help with this, you're gonna have to use the internet, and I could be of minimal assistance. I could help you through the, like, if you get stuck, I can help you conceptually, but when it comes to the nuances of this,
right, the syntax of it,
I just want to let you know that, like, I am not that person yet. And then after that, we finished the interview, et cetera, et cetera. And I was just like, at that moment, I was like, oh, you know, it would be kind of nice to know this. And so I actually pair programmed with one of my coworkers, and I was like, hey, do you want to do this interview question with me with using React Hooks? So I drove and he navigated, and that experience of doing that interview question using React Hooks, I was like, dang, this is actually like a really clean way to do this. And
that's cool.
I was just like sold instantly. And I think it's because I didn't want to take that leap because I just needed someone to hold my hand through the process of reaffirming that I'm doing things correctly. And I think that instance of pair programming, shout out Extreme Programming, I think that instance of pair programming really sold me on it.
Yeah, I think pair programming is, again, like the times that I agree to adopt a new technology or way of working is often come through pair programming or inheriting a project from a client. Like, oh, seeing like, wow, the last developer did it this way. That's actually a really interesting approach. And yeah, I think it's just like getting your hands dirty on it. But I do think there's a lesson there that, you know, maybe if you got your hands dirty earlier, you'd see the value. But I think there's a balance. I think I'm way too on the spectrum of waiting way too long for things to mature. And then there's, you know, the other side, which is being way too reactive to what the newest hotness is out there. And that's a whole episode in itself. Cool. Great pick. Awesome stuff. My pick for the week is a blog post by, I don't remember her name. Her name's not on her website, so that's her fault. But it was a tweet that went out and it kind of went quasi-viral. And this is the quote. This is the quote from the tweet. So, quote, in an attempt to dispel the idea that if you Google stuff, you're not a proper engineer, this is a list of nearly everything I Googled in a week at work, where I'm a software engineer with several years experience, end quote. And I linked this in the show notes, but basically like it just has a label, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and it's everything this professional, you know, software engineer Googled for a week. And I love this idea of being okay and being humble enough to admit, like, we all Google all the time, and that's a part of what we do, whether it's a syntax or how to start up a specific tool or what that thing is. And I just love this idea because it very much pops the bubble on all of our imposter syndrome. It's like, nobody's perfect. I was just listening to a podcast the other day with DHH where he was kind of talking about some of these ideas. It's like, we all want to be the developer who's up on our ivory tower, who has the correct answer for everything, for every bubble sort algorithm. And it's just not the case, and that's okay. And it's okay that we allow brain space to have other things. And like, let's all have some fucking humility and not be mean to each other. And I just love this as just the courage that she had to put that out there is really cool. Like I would be super embarrassed by all the things that I Google every week. But I think this is a really interesting practice. And I just think it's a good example and a good reminder that we all feel like we're posers. We all forget the syntax on a JavaScript import sometime. Like whatever the thing is, like we all forget it sometimes.
Cool. Yeah. Two thoughts. First is this was a tweet by Sophie Koonin, who's
there we go.
Super big in the, I think, JavaScript community. I follow her. I know her bio says React and Go, so that's probably what it is. Super cool. I love her handle, Type Error. Like, how do you get that? Anyways, second thought is when I read your pick of everything I Googled for a week, I thought this was going to be like some like web app or service that shows you everything that you Googled for a week.
Interesting.
But having heard what this actually is, I think that would be super cool to just like catalog all the stuff you Google.
Yeah, right.
Man, I got to do that because the way that I search for things in Google, I literally type out sentences. I don't know why I do this, but most of the time I find what I need to find. But yeah, I definitely take a look at her blog post or tweet or whatever it was that shows like...
Yeah, she tweeted a link to her blog post and that's the overall idea there. And I just love that idea in general. So cool. Thanks everyone so much for listening and we will see you next episode.
Peace.